Hello.
Good morning.
Hello.
Greetings. Who's on board right now?
Well, Dr. Solomon and I are here. This is Linda.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
This
is Jill with, Jill with Colorado Agribility.
Hi, Jill.
Hi. This is Ellen with Maine Agribility.
Hello, Ellen.
Hello.
We're a little ahead of time, so we'll give it a few more minutes before we get started. Hello.
Randy Weigel, Wyoming.
Hi, Randy.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. This is Maria calling from California Agribility. Karina and Gloria are also joining.
I think I know you guys.
Yes.
It's Linda.
They were actually the catalyst for this call, so.
And they're here to hear it again? Good gosh, ladies.
Must be pretty good. We'll wait another couple minutes.
Sure.
I think we'll go ahead and get started. I know some people, I got an email indicating that at least one of our members was not going to be able to make it, but we are recording the call, so we'll have it available for those that were not able to join us and for the other Agribility staff that might be interested in listening in. So it's our privilege today to have Dr. Joel Solomon and Linda Eaton from Mercy General Hospital in California to talk about traumatic brain injury. And so we'll let them present for as long as they want, and then we'll have a time for question and answers. I know this is a topic that's very relevant to us, especially these days with returning veterans. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Solomon and Linda.
All righty. Actually, we have, and you did say that we can talk for as long as we want to. Be careful what you say. We could talk forever.
Okay.
But we will keep it to probably about 30 minutes or so, and then if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask questions as we go. Please don't worry about interrupting us. We're here to answer your questions on traumatic brain injury, but also give you some basic general knowledge about the disability and about ways that you can maybe help somebody that you're working with a traumatic brain injury. So just to get started off, I'd like to go over just some brain injury basics. There is a difference between an acquired brain injury and a traumatic brain injury. An acquired brain injury is any injury to the brain that is acquired after birth. So a traumatic brain injury is a type of an acquired brain injury, but there are other types of acquired brain injuries, such as strokes, brain tumors, anoxia, which means that a lack of oxygen to the brain, but also a traumatic brain injury is a type of an acquired brain injury. So you may see people with strokes, but also people with traumatic brain injuries. And we mainly work in our grant program with people with traumatic brain injuries. And what that means, the definition of a traumatic brain injury is any brain injury that's caused by an external mechanical force. So that could be someone hitting their head in a car accident. It could be a gunshot wound. It could be a whole bunch of different things that will cause a traumatic brain injury. The most common are transport injuries, such as cars or bicycle accidents or boating accidents. But also right behind them are falls. There's falls that happen to children, and there's also a lot of falls that happen in our elderly. You know, when you think about grandma falling and breaking her hip, that's really not the biggest thing that you need to be worried about. You need to worry about grandma falling and hitting her head and having a traumatic brain injury subsequently. There's also violence, which causes traumatic brain injuries, fights, gunshot wounds, assaults, domestic violence. Shaken baby syndrome is another type of a violent traumatic brain injury. And also really big in the news these days is the recreational or sports injuries. I don't know if you guys have been following, you know, Major League or the NFL and the concussion talks and lawsuits and all kinds of stuff. There's a big push now to increase the education on concussions and also the follow-up care that needs to be done in order to make sure that concussions don't essentially turn into a more severe type of brain injury. Any questions on that stuff? Okay, the incidence of traumatic brain injury. There's 1.7 million Americans that sustain a traumatic brain injury each year. And that number is probably smaller than the actual number. That number is the number of reported traumatic brain injuries, but there's a whole bunch of concussions and mild traumatic brain injuries that aren't ever reported because people get their bell rung, essentially, and then don't seek medical attention. More than 52,000 people die each year from traumatic brain injury, and over 5.3 million Americans live with disabilities resulting from a TBI. And as it was mentioned before, the signature injury of the Iraqi and Afghanistan conflicts or wars is traumatic brain injury. There's a lot of blast injuries, there's concussions that are happening to our soldiers, and they're coming back with mild traumatic brain injuries, and so we need to figure out how best to serve them. One of my favorite statistics, and Dr. Solomon hears this all the time, with traumatic brain injury is 6 times more prevalent than multiple sclerosis, HIV/AIDS, spinal cord injury, and breast cancer combined. That's a lot of people. If we had the awareness that the breast cancer people do, you know, in my perfect world, we would have green everywhere instead of pink. Green is the signature color for brain injury. Who's most at risk for a traumatic brain injury? As I said before, the young, the 0 to 4 age group, it has a high prevalence because of falls and also because of domestic violence. Adolescents, again, that's those 15 to 19-year-old, mainly males, that do that risk-taking behavior that can sometimes lead them down the path to a traumatic brain injury. And then also, as I mentioned, the elderly with their risk of falls. Males are 3 times more likely than females to have a traumatic brain injury. And also, as you can imagine, alcohol greatly increases the risk of having a traumatic brain injury. It impairs their judgment, it impairs balance and coordination, and it increases reaction time. So if they get themselves into a pickle, they're not able to get themselves out of it quite as easily. So how do you know how severe a traumatic brain injury is? When you guys see clients that have a traumatic brain injury, They are usually classified in three different ways. They're usually classified mild, moderate, and severe. And the way that the medical community will classify them is based on three different things. One is a Glasgow Coma Scale, which is a rating scale that they use either in the field or in the emergency room. They also look at how long they lost consciousness for. If they did lose consciousness, if they lose consciousness for any more than a day, they're considered a severe traumatic brain injury. And also we look at their post-traumatic amnesia, which is what is the last thing that they remember before the accident and what's the first thing they remember after the accident. And that amount of time can give us an indicator as to how severe the injury is. If they, you know, remember the hit that they took on the football field and then woke up on the sidelines, you know, 2 or 3 minutes later and everybody's huddled around them, that's a different clinical picture than if someone was in a car accident and they don't remember 2 days before the accident and they really don't remember anything until they got to the rehab hospital 3 weeks later. So as you can tell, that's probably a much more significant injury than the guy on the sidelines. There are different types of brain injuries. There's open versus closed. An open head injury results in a skull fracture. So there's some kind of fracture to the skull. A closed head injury is where there's no skull fracture. So obviously, like a bullet wound would result in an open brain or an open head injury. But there's a lot of brain injuries, a lot of severe brain injuries that happen where there is no fracture. And that can actually work against them. There are primary versus secondary injuries. Primary injuries occur at the time of the impact. So there are bruises in the brain. There are lacerations or tears in the brain. I'm sure you guys have heard of subdural hematomas or epidural hematomas, and those are blood clots in the brain. And those are all significant injuries that you can see on an MRI or a CT scan. One thing to note is that if there is a hematoma, if there is bleeding in the brain, blood is toxic to brain tissue. So any time that blood touches any of the neurons in the brain, they die. So there's going to be some permanent brain damage anytime anybody has bleeding in the brain. There's also, though, what's called a diffuse axonal injury that doesn't necessarily show up on an MRI. And what happens with a diffuse axonal injury is that many times, say in an automobile accident, the car's traveling at 30 miles an hour, hits a pole, and what happens is that the brain continues to travel forward within the skull. Well, the skull is a closed case, so it bounces off the front of the skull, but then it also rebounds and it bounces back. So there's what's called a coup contra coup injury, where the brain will sustain damage in the front of the brain, but also on the opposite side in the back or side to side or whichever way the force is traveling, it'll have an injury on one side of the brain and then a counteracting injury on the opposite side of the brain. Those also, your brain is also made up of different layers, and those layers are connected by different pathways and neurons. And what happens is that as your brain is traveling forward, those different layers travel at different speeds because of the different densities. And if the brain slams into the front of the skull, there's a chance that those interconnections between the different layers can be injured. And so those connections are lost, and that's where you have the diffuse axonal injury. So that's what leads to sometimes the memory problems and the speech problems and the other problems that we're going to talk about that can happen after a significant brain injury. There's also, though, so those are all the primary injuries. There's also secondary injuries that can occur at the time of the accident. Or the secondary injuries that occur, you know, within hours afterwards or days afterwards. And sometimes those can be more life-threatening than the actual injury itself. One of the biggest is the swelling that can happen in the brain. If you can imagine, this brain's being rattled around inside the skull. And it, just like your knee or your back or your arm, if it's bruised, it's going to swell. And when the brain swells, it's in a closed environment. There's nowhere for the brain to go except through what's called the foramen magnum. And the foramen magnum is a large hole at the bottom of the skull where the spinal cord goes through and where the brainstem connects with the spinal cord. If the brain swells enough, the brain tissue and the brainstem can be pushed down through that foramen magnum and lead to death. And that previously, before we were really good at being able to control the swelling in the brain after a brain injury, that's how a lot of the patients died 20, 30 years ago. Nowadays, what they'll do oftentimes is if you've worked with somebody with a brain injury, you might recognize a horseshoe-shaped kind of scar on the side of their head. Many times if the brain is swelling, they will literally take off part of the skull to allow that brain to swell, to allow the brain to heal, and then once it has decreased in size again, they'll put the bone flap back in. So on that note, I'm going to let Dr. Solomon talk to you guys about recovery following a traumatic brain injury.
All right, so picking up where that leaves off puts us at the early recovery stage after an injury, and oftentimes reviewing a person's history, you may find out that the person was in a coma. And if a person's in a coma, that does equate to some degree of brain damage. The severity of that damage varies based on a number of different factors, which I'll talk about shortly. But if you read or hear that somebody was in a coma, that is a reflection of some degree of damage to the brain. In the early recovery after an injury, the most rapid improvements occur in the first 6 to 12 months following the injury. That physical recovery of the brain tends to plateau in over the period of 12 to 24 months after an injury. So the most rapid recovery is in the first 6 to 12 months, slowly plateauing within the first year to 2 years post-injury. After that time, the physical healing of the brain has stopped, but that does not mean that recovery has stopped at that point. It does not mean that things cannot get better, but it does reflect that the physical healing of the brain has stopped. After that year to two-year window of time in which the brain is physically healing, things would get better by people learning to adapt, adjust, and accommodate to their difficulties, rather than things improving just because the brain tissue is continuing to recover. I referenced earlier that there's a lot of variability in terms of recovery following an injury, and some of the factors that contribute to that variability include things such as the severity of the injury, how old the person was at the time of the injury, the amount of social support that they have, their financial resources, and their availability to rehab services, and a lot of individual factors such as their prior level of functioning. So a person's educational and occupational history, a person's previous health status, previous personality strengths and liabilities, pre-existing psychiatric conditions, substance abuse, all of those factors can influence how a person is going to recover from an injury. Certainly a higher functioning person would likely have a greater recovery following an injury compared to a person who had a similar injury but had a lower level of functioning previously. After this time period has elapsed and we're at a year or 2 years post-injury, there can be a number of long-term sequelae following an injury. And those long-term issues can fall into three general categories. We can have physical or sensory changes, we can have cognitive changes that affect the way the person thinks, or we can have emotional or behavioral changes. Some of the physical changes that are commonly seen are things such as fatigue, weaknesses, dizziness, headaches. Sensory changes that are very common include hypersensitivity to all sensory input. So whether that's hypersensitivity to lights or sounds or visual chaos or clutter, those sorts of things. Changes in hearing, smell, taste, vision, all of those things can occur and affect the person physically after an injury to the brain, depending on the part of the brain that was affected. cognitive changes after injury can often result in changes in a person's attention, their ability to focus, their ability to concentrate. They can be more easily distractible, more easily overwhelmed. Oftentimes they process information much slower than before, or they can't process as much information at one time. There can be changes in memory, changes in their ability to learn new information, changes in planning or judgment or problem solving. Those are executive functions that are often affected. There can be changes in language, visual perception. All of these areas could be affected depending on the type of injury that a person suffered and the parts of the brain that have been impacted. In terms of emotions and behavioral functioning, these types of things can fall into two separate categories. There can be sort of these neurologically mediated changes, or they can be more psychological and emotional reactions. And what I mean by that, neurologically mediated changes are changes in emotional or behavioral functioning that occur because of actual change to the brain tissue and the neural networks themselves. Whereas psychological or emotional reactions are more emotional or behavioral responses to this dramatic life change. So for example, neurologically mediated changes might be things such as impulsivity or temper outbursts or sometimes emotional blunting. These are things that may occur because the parts of the brain that control management or expression of these emotions have been damaged themselves. So a person may not experience emotion the same way as they did before, not because of depression or because of some sort of mood change, but because the part of the brain that allows them to process emotion and express emotion, that part of the brain has been damaged, which can result in some of these changes. So again, some neurologically mediated changes would also be lack of awareness of a person's deficits, misperceiving other people, lack of initiation. This is a significant one that sometimes after an injury, people won't be as active, won't be as engaged in behaviors and activities and responsibilities, and it sometimes gets misconstrued as depression, as if the person doesn't want to do something or have the emotional energy to do something, but in reality, it's a lack of initiation. The thought to begin a behavior or begin an activity does not occur to the person. Again, not because they're depressed or they don't have the energy to do it, but because the part of the brain that gets them going in an activity has been affected. On the flip side, or not on the flip side, but another component is this psychological or emotional reaction. And this is what people experience when they're adjusting emotionally to this dramatic change in their life. So oftentimes, this makes sense in the context of any injury. If somebody were to break a leg or injure their back or neck and not be able to engage in many of the activities that they used to do, there would be an understandable and normal emotional response to that. It might be depression, it might be anger, it might be fear, it might be anxiety, but it would be a normal response to not being able to do the things that a person used to do or live the life in the way that they used to live their life. And so this obviously can happen in brain injury. Perhaps a person is no longer able to work at their job, or a person is no longer able to drive, or a person is no longer able to live independently or express their thoughts and ideas with the same fluidity that they used to, or any of those things. A person may often experience depression or anger or fear or anxiety or any of these other sorts of common emotional responses. And so these things can all combine in individuals after injury to affect their functioning in a myriad of ways. So transitioning now, we're going to hit on some different issues and difficulties people may have after injury and touch on some strategies that may be helpful in addressing those issues.
All right. And I am not going to, It says here that we're going to be talking about how to minimize risk for potentially dangerous tasks like operating heavy machinery. I can honestly tell you that I have never operated a heavy machine in my life, so I'm not sure exactly what's involved in that, but we are going to go through, and Dr. Solomon talked about a lot of different things that can happen to somebody after they have a traumatic brain injury and a lot of different challenges that they have. We're going to go through some of those and give you some real hands-on ways to help the people with those particular difficulties. First one, almost across the board, anyone with a brain injury has trouble with memory. They have difficulty remembering information from day to day. They have difficulty remembering information over time. And so here's some strategies for helping them remember things and become more efficient. Over time, I'm not sure if we mentioned this yet, but typically after, there's what's called a golden year after a traumatic brain injury, and it's kind of a misnomer because it's really a golden 18 months or 2 years. But typically after about 18 months to 2 years, the brain itself has healed as much as it's going to heal. What that means is what you see is what you get. There's not going to be any more spontaneous recovery. And so if they're still having memory problems at that time, then chances are it's not going to get much better by itself over time. But in contrast to that, I have treated patients or people with traumatic brain injuries, you know, 30 years post, 20 years post, and it's not that their memory gets better, but it's that they are able to use what they've got better. And so if you can teach them strategies for how to be more efficient and effective on the job, then that means that they're going to be more efficient and effective on the job. So here's some strategies for you. For somebody who has difficulty remembering information, make sure that you provide written information whenever you can. Obviously, that'll give them something tangible to look at and to refer to when you're not there and not have to rely on their memory. Encourage the consumer themselves to write down information in a notebook so that they can keep it. Then you're using two modalities. You're not just handing them a piece of paper, but you're having them use their manual skills to be able to write it down, and sometimes that, using two different modalities, being able to hear it, being able to see it, and being able to write it themselves, can also help get that information into their brain where they can retrieve it later. Remind the consumer to refer to their notebook often. A lot of times they'll write things down on sticky notes and then forget where the sticky note is, so then obviously the sticky note doesn't help much. So encourage them to use a notebook that they carry around with them. Also encourage either the use of a day planner or a calendar. And nowadays, smartphones are so good. All of us, many, many, many of us, carry smartphones. And so it's not a stigma anymore. You know, when I first started working with brain injury, we'd have the clients walk around with these big old notebooks, and they didn't like that because then they looked different than everyone else. But nowadays, everyone's carrying a smartphone. They can use it as a memo pad. They can use it as their daily calendar. They have alarms that can help them remember things if they know how to set them. So the use of a smartphone or even just a regular phone for their calendar is a wonderful, wonderful technology that should be used with anybody with a TBI. Also, it's very important. I know that we are consumer-driven, and I know that it is important to empower the individual to be able to advocate for themselves. But someone with a traumatic brain injury has cognitive difficulties that can sometimes be helped if a family member or a friend is there as well. If there's an important meeting or if there is something that they really need that is important that they understand and that they retain, we oftentimes will have family members come to our team meetings so that they can have someone else who's heard the exact same information that if they go into the next room for the next day and not remember exactly what was said, they have somebody to reference who can give them the information that was given again. I hope that makes sense. Also, part of, you know, some people just have bad memories after a traumatic brain injury. Sometimes the part of the brain that stores information is damaged, but also a lot of times we find that their actual memories are not so bad, but that they have difficulty focusing and paying attention. And if you can imagine, if you have an individual that's not paying attention, he could have the best memory in the world, but there, the information is not going to be in there to be retrieved later because it never got in the first place. Things that you can do to help someone with attentional problems are to make sure that they work in an area with limited distractions. I know that there are a lot of noisy environments out in the workplace, but it really does help these individuals if they can work in a more quiet area with limited distractions. Be aware of noises like radios, other people talking, and try and limit those as much as possible. If you can, and if you can remember, especially if it's in a loud or a noisy environment, make sure that the consumer is looking at you and paying attention to you when you give instructions, and have them repeat back what they heard, because oftentimes they'll sit there and they'll nod their heads just like everyone else does, and it didn't get in. Be sure to have them, and then also refocus their attention if they do become distracted. So you can play around with those. Also, you'll find that if it is just too distracting of an environment, you either need to move the meeting to a less distracting environment or reschedule the session for another time when they're at their best. If they're tired, they're not going to be able to pay attention as well as they would as if they're fresh. Dr. Solomon talked a little bit about initiation. There are many times where I've had either family members or team members or other people that are working with someone with a traumatic brain injury come in and say, you know what, Mark is so lazy. And if you keep talking with them, you know, he never takes out the garbage and he never does anything and he just sits on the couch and he just watches TV and sometimes Mark's not lazy, but the idea to take out the garbage or the idea to do something other than sit on the couch doesn't occur to Mark, and so he just sits there. And that's kind of what lack of initiation is. It's bad to get labeled as lazy when really, if the idea popped in your head, you'd do it, but it just doesn't go there. So what you need to do with someone who has a lack of initiation is to establish some routines. Establish daily routines. That way they don't have to think of what to do next. They know what to do next. And that's a way where they will get up every morning and take a shower and eat breakfast and do their chores. And if they can get into a routine, it is much more likely that they will initiate the activities than if they're just left to their own devices. It also helps for initiation if you break down activities into simpler steps. Sometimes if cleaning out the garage is way too big of a task, they will just walk away, like all of us would, like I did last weekend. But if you say, I'm just going to clean out this corner, then it's much easier for them to initiate and complete a simple task and then take baby steps towards completing the bigger task. Checklists of activities are good. Establish time frames when each task needs to be completed. Use a watch or a clock that's programmed to ring or vibrate to indicate the start and the end of a task, and then provide reminders and encouragement. Also, oftentimes, our consumers have difficulty with organization and planning, and that kind of goes along with the initiation as well. If they have a big task, help them develop a written plan. If they're going to be working, you know, at this one day, make sure that they have a routine. If they have different job duties, make sure that they can complete one job duty before they start another one. It's much easier to do that for somebody with a brain injury than it is to multitask. Also, it's a good idea sometimes to assign different activities for different days of the week. That way, there's not just a routine within each day, but also a routine within a week. And then make sure that you review the plan often. To make sure that it's still working for them and doesn't need any modifications.
So some of the other areas to look at would be if they have difficulty with social situations. So sometimes after an injury, people may have difficulty getting along with coworkers or bosses or family or friends. It's important to understand that sometimes these individuals don't recognize the degree or the way in which their behavior impacts others. And so, and they may also not be really in tune with the social boundaries and how their behavior may no longer be consistent with social boundaries. So it's important that these people receive feedback about their behavior, that individuals who've had these injuries have an understanding of how their behavior can in fact affect other people. And sometimes it takes multiple times of getting this feedback before they start to incorporate that into their own understanding and awareness of their behavior. But having clear expectations about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate, along with consistent positive feedback, will be important in shaping that behavior. And that doesn't mean that when somebody does something that's inappropriate that they don't get informed about that and they only get positive feedback. But the more that the feedback can be supportive and structured in a positive shaping light rather than a scolding or harsh approach, the more likely it will be retained. The more that they can be aware of potential consequences of their behavior, the better. One environment in which this may come up may be with interviews or meeting with other people in a professional or work context. Sometimes role-playing behaviors, highlighting appropriate behaviors or appropriate comments or questions, and shedding light on things that would not be so appropriate in the context of a role play can be a good way to have sort of a dry run in terms of those experiences. Another area where sometimes people have difficulty is with controlling emotions, and I mentioned that earlier, talking about maybe impulsivity or anger outbursts or shorter frustration tolerance or those sorts of things. When interacting with folks who are experiencing these types of things, it's important to remain calm yourselves and model appropriate calm behavior. Oftentimes, folks will mirror the behavior that they see in others. So the more you're able to remain calm yourself and speak in a calm and collected and soothing manner, it's likely that the behavior may be mimicked to some degree by the person who has the injury. Again, constructive and consistent feedback is going to be important in terms of people being able to increase their own self-awareness of their behavior and their responses. Sometimes also, folks who've had injuries can be redirected onto a different topic. So if they're upset about something in particular, and if the topic gets shifted to something else that they may be interested in or distracted by, this can provide an opportunity to shift them away from the thing that's escalating their emotional response into something that may be more soothing or calming. And lastly, I want to just touch briefly on difficulty with self-awareness. Sometimes after an injury, I mentioned this briefly before, that the part of the brain that allows people to recognize that they have difficulties, that part of the brain itself may be injured, in which case people may not be fully aware of the deficits that they have or the difficulties that they have. And so sometimes they don't really have an accurate understanding of their own personal strengths and weaknesses. So knowing that this may be a possible issue that they're dealing with can certainly be helpful for you going into working with somebody like this. But also it can be helpful to have education and input from outside people. The more consistent the feedback, both from yourselves and from family or from medical providers or whoever, the more consistent the feedback, the more it's going to be more prominent in their own self-awareness and hopefully become more incorporated into how they view themselves. And as they recover from injury, they're more likely to recognize these difficulties when they see them in their own day-to-day functioning. Now, certainly that's not true for everybody. There may be people whose deficits in these areas persist and they don't ever really accommodate or don't ever really recognize the difficulties despite the feedback from others, but oftentimes as the recovery process takes place and there is this consistent feedback from others and this consistent awareness in their own functioning, there can be some improvement in this regard. So I realize we've touched on a lot of information in a short time.
I actually just wanted to add a little something about fatigue. One of the main physicals, you know, almost everyone has difficulties with memory. And another almost universal thing that we found in our work with traumatic brain injury survivors is fatigue. Because not only sometimes does it take more energy to be able to move because of spasticity or weakness or whatever, but also just because going through life takes more thought, conscious thought, they get not only physical fatigue like we do at the end of a hard day, but if you can remember your first couple of days on a job and you're learning stuff and your brain is going 100 miles a minute and you have that awful fatigue at the end of the day, that's called cognitive fatigue, and our clients experience that almost on a daily basis. So as far as work goes, you need to take that into account. A lot of times, especially when they're first coming back from their injuries, it's very difficult for them to work full-time. So we almost universally recommend going back part-time for maybe 4 hours a day, 3 days a week, and then working up if they can to full-time. Some people never are able to work full-time, but also to also find the time of day where they are their best cognitively and physically. A lot of times it's in the morning where most of our guys will be able to function better because they're not quite as tired, but by mid to late afternoon, they are toast. They're done. So if you can find a survivor's best time of day when they feel best and they're functioning at their best and capitalize on that for work, that's also something that you might want to keep in mind. Any questions?
Well, thank you for that excellent overview. I have some questions myself. This is Paul, but I'll open it up to others on the call before I start in on mine. Other people have questions?
Well, this is Ellen from Maine Agribility, and I worked with a person who had who was mauled by a bull 20 years ago, and lost consciousness and had a lot of physical problems. I mean, they didn't think that he was going to walk again, but he's walking, and he's he's back on the farm.
My goodness.
Yeah. Well, but he's a very belligerent sort of person. I mean, he's really hard-edged. And his wife thinks that he's got some depression, which I think she attributes to be, that sort of feeling of what he used to be like versus what he is now, although it's been 20 years, and so he's adjusted a lot. But how do you work with somebody who may have residual problems from a brain injury, but it's a long time ago, and, how do you broach that with a person who, would probably be in denial?
Well, obviously that can be very complicated. Has this person had any sorts of outside services along the 20-some years since this injury in terms of physical and or psychological
rehab?
He's had a lot of physical rehab, but it was one of my first assessments, and I was pretty green, and I didn't get into psychological assessments. It didn't come up.
And is this somebody you're still working with?
Yes, I am still working with him.
And so your question is, how do you broach these issues with him?
Yeah, how do you, how do you make a suggestion that, it might be something to look into?
I think your inroad is, from what you're saying, your inroad would be his wife. If she's suggested that she feels like these might be some issues that he could be dealing with, I think one of the biggest things, one of the biggest things with injury that can be helpful is normalizing for people what these sorts of experiences are like. That it's most people, unless they've known somebody who's had an injury like this before, most people don't have the slightest idea what to expect. They don't have the slightest idea what things are going to be like and what recovery is going to be like, and that it's things might never be the way they were before, and that it's normal to have anger or grief or loss or depression or those sorts of things. So oftentimes they can, you know, especially in our culture, we romanticize the rugged individualist who just sort of deals with everything on, you know, by his or herself. And a lot of times people just try to suck it up and deal with it, thinking that, well, this is just my problem to deal with. And the more that we can normalize these things for people and let them know that, you know, it's common for people to have this type of problem or that type of problem, or it's common for people to have depression or anger, or it's common for people to have difficulty focusing and concentrating and remembering and those sorts of things, by reassuring them about these types of difficulties, it can oftentimes open them up to, first of all, acknowledging that some of this might be going on, and then being more willing to addressing it. So if you're able to work with this person and just address that some of these things would be common for a person who has an injury, and that, you know, sometimes they can get better if they, you know, work with somebody who understands injury, brain injury, and work with somebody who understands, you know, these types of adjustment reactions, then that can be very reassuring to a person.
What we've also found out, too, is that, I mean, was he a crusty individual before the accident? Do you know?
I think he was.
Because
yeah.
A lot of times what we find is that brain injury doesn't change someone's personality per se, but it can intensify it because the filters that are there, and typically with frontal lobe injuries, the filter is messed with, and so the filter is not as good. And so if he was a crusty individual before, sometimes after an injury he's going to be even more crusty because there's not that stop gap where the brain says, okay, this is inappropriate, so I'm not going to say this. They just say it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the injury as well. So that can be an education for the wife, but he can also learn to make that filter work a little bit better as well.
Ellen, do you know if he's getting the feedback from others, like was mentioned earlier in the call? Is he getting the feedback that he is this way, he is belligerent, or do people just kind of assume he's going to be that way and not even...
By birth.
I think he does get feedback, but I think he assumes that that's the way he is, that it's just gradually, if it has intensified over time, he's kind of... He is not cognizant of what's happening with him. It's just the way, you know, it's just the way I am.
Right,
right.
That's
the way he is. That's how he looks at it.
Mm-hmm.
And
but if he knows that this is not just the way he is, if he knows that this is the brain injury, because it's not just the way he is. This is from the brain injury, and it can be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe over time that kind of education can help.
And I think Ellen brings up a point. I think that a lot of our staff have to deal with in a variety of different situations and issues, and that's that rugged individualism that you mentioned before, that, you know, there is a reluctance to get help of any kind sometimes.
Absolutely. I can imagine.
Good question, Ellen. Any others right now from others? One thing I was wondering about, you talked about the memory issue being universal. Is it primarily short-term memory, long-term memory, or is it really possible to tell what you would typically find?
Okay. Dr. Solomon just stepped out for a second, and I'm a physical therapist, but I'm going to try. How's that?
Okay.
The memory actually with a traumatic brain injury, the long-term memory is almost always intact. So they can remember their second grade teacher, and they can remember where they went to high school, and they can remember their wives and their family members when they come out of coma. Long-term memory is stored in a different part of the brain than is short-term memory. What happens is that new learning and short-term memory are the ones that are affected. They can remember their second grade teacher, but they can't remember what they had for breakfast.
Okay, and that kind of relates to the machinery issue I had kind of thrown at you, prepared for. But for example, we got a farmer that's 55 years old, has been farming all his life, and he gets in a car accident and gets a traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably more likely then to forget where he left the tractor than he is to forgetting how to operate the tractor. Would you say that's
exactly, absolutely. If it is long-term memory, what we found is that clients that go back to a job that they knew before, they have a much better chance of success than they do if they are trying to learn a new system. Like I have a client right now who's an executive at HP. He was out for 8 months. He remembers all of his job tasks that he had to do before, even the big project management stuff, which is amazing that he's able to do that. But they have a new operating system in, and he's having a really hard time with the new learning of learning that new system, whereas he could have gone back to the old one and been fine.
Well, I think that may be a very practical thing for us to remember with our clients, because somebody getting a different tractor or a different piece of machinery they haven't had before, a different type of baler or a skid steer loader or something that's not familiar may be a problem, whereas something that they've used for 20 years,
they'll hop right back on it.
Right. So that might be something to think about when we're working with them in terms of the new types of machinery that they might be getting.
That's also, though, not to say that they would necessarily do fine with the original thing, because sometimes their difficulties may be such that it has indeed impaired or negatively impacted their ability to do the original machinery or whatever. But, yes, oftentimes, physically or cognitively, maybe it is complicated, and now they have difficulty doing all the multitasking that's required of operating this machinery that they've used for 20 years. But it would be fair to say that oftentimes it is much more difficult to learn the new task than return to a more familiar task.
Kind of along with that, we've struggled, on a variety of occasions with people that, for example, wanted to operate a tractor, but they had an impairment, for example, a seizure disorder, epilepsy or some other condition that raised a significant concern about their safety. And I guess one of the things or kind of rules of thumb that we've used in the past is we don't recommend that somebody operate a tractor or a piece of machinery like that unless they are able to be certified to drive a vehicle on the road. And
absolutely.
I don't know if that's I just kind of want to run that past you to see what you thought about. I don't know if we've ever really, checked with people about that, but it seemed to be reasonable to us, I guess.
That's certainly the way that we would go about it. I know with regard to driving, we can't legally or formally have any input with regard to whether or not someone can drive, but we definitely make the same recommendation that they need to be cleared physically, they need to be cleared legally, they need to be signed off on by their medical doc to be able to drive, and we extend that to other things as well, telling people not to use power tools and stuff like that. And so we would definitely approach that the same way if we had folks doing heavy machinery.
And it's a state law that they have to be seizure-free for 6 months.
To drive.
Right.
So they have to be stable on their seizure meds as a basic criteria, and then all the other stuff comes into play, impulsivity and visual perception and, all that kind of stuff.
So if, for example, one of our staff members did have questions about, whether this person should do this task or another task or something, what would be your recommendation in terms of the path that they would follow for recommending some type of an assessment process? Would it be through neurologist or a occupational therapist or physical therapist, or what would be some suggestions you might have in that area?
Usually for those kind of assessments, either an occupational therapist or a physical therapist would be the best. A neurologist, what the course would be is that you would refer them to a physician, and then the physician would refer them to the therapist. Therapist could give their recommendations back to the physician and then back to you. That way you can get Medi-Cal or Medicare or their insurance to cover it. But if you just go straight to the therapist, it won't be covered by insurance.
Okay.
And there are people, there are actually, you might even, depending upon where you are in the state or in the nation, you might even double check with your Department of Rehab, your vocational rehab department, because they may have specific therapists that they use for those assessments, and they might be able to give you referrals.
Okay, thanks. That's good. Good idea. Coming up to the end of our hour, does anybody have other questions? I had one more that I thought about. You'd indicated that traumatic brain injury, is different from an acquired brain injury in that there's a traumatic event. So how does traumatic brain injury relate to post-traumatic stress disorder, because that also involves a traumatic event? And is there overlap between symptoms? Do you have to sort that out? For example, if somebody's been in a crime attack, what symptoms are they experiencing because of the PTSD versus what are they experiencing because of the actual brain injury?
All right, so there's an interesting overlap and interconnection between traumatic brain injury and PTSD. One of the, I suppose, fortunate things about traumatic brain injury is that oftentimes, even though it is caused by a trauma, it's not accompanied by PTSD, oftentimes, because of the fact that most people don't remember the trauma of their traumatic brain injury. They have, because of that, the impact of their memory, the amnesia surrounding the event, it's often that there's no recollection of the fear of the injury. There's no recollection of this thought that their life is in danger, their safety is in danger, and those sorts of things that often accompany post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, that's not to say that PTSD can't occur for TBI, because certainly it can and it does, but oftentimes where if a person were in a car accident and had a lot of bodily injuries but did not have an injury to their brain, they would be more likely to have experienced PTSD afterwards than if they had the brain injury, because of the amnesia that's often accompanied by the brain injury. Now, going back to the question of overlapping symptoms, there certainly can be some correlation of symptoms, but oftentimes in PTSD, the symptoms are primarily psychiatric and behavioral, although they can affect some of the cognitive and functional symptoms. But in PTSD, people get a lot of avoidance, or they get re-experiencing, or they have hypervigilance or hyperarousal or those sorts of things, whereas often those symptoms are not things that are experienced in just traumatic brain injury itself. There can be emotional stressors after TBI, but where they correlate with PTSD would be more often in the functional way, in that both of them can negatively interfere with a person's engagement with the world around them and how they interact with the people around them and those sorts of things. Certainly treatment is available for PTSD, and teasing those two apart, though, often isn't, when they're both present in the same individual, teasing them apart, the symptoms of one versus the other, often isn't that complex because, like I said, the PTSD symptoms are very much psychiatric and behavioral, whereas the types of behavioral symptoms from TBI are often different in nature than what you would see in PTSD. So if they were referred to somebody for treatment, it wouldn't necessarily be that complex in terms of helping differentiate the two.
Great. Thank you. That's a good points about the amnesia and also the different symptoms there. Thank you. Okay, we're almost at the end of our hour. I want to just open it up one final time. Anybody has any quick questions? Well, again, we want to thank Dr. Solomon and Ms. Eaton for sharing today. It's, I think, a very good overview and some valuable information that a lot of our AgriBility staff can use. We're going to be archiving this call and making it available, so I think it could be useful for a long time to come. So thank you again for participating. Those who were able to join us, and I will just give an opportunity for those that came on late, if you wanted to acknowledge your presence and let me know that you're on the call. I appreciate that. Anybody that came on and didn't announce themselves yet?
Tom Yockman from Vermont.
Thanks, Tom.
Kirk in Virginia.
Okay, Kirk, thank you.
And also, if you have my contact information. If you have any questions, feel free to forward them, and we'll do the best we can.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.